Good morning.
Morning.
Very good. I'd be disappointed if you weren't right awake this morning. As you know, I'm at my best right now. So if this talk doesn't come over too good, I would suggest it's the problems with you, not with me. Okay? So that's very important to. I usually tell my wife at home whenever we start any kind of project, the first thing we need to do is to determine who's going to get blamed when things go wrong. So I just did that for you. Oh, it's your fault. All right? So anyway, I'm going to talk today about design and astronomy, and you may wonder, well, how does that relate to this? It should be obvious, but I'll go through this very quickly. There are basically two explanations of how we and the world around us came to be. One of them would be evolution, which I will define as a purely natural, purely physical process. Now, if there were an evolutionary biologist here this morning, they would jump up and down and complain. They'd say that's not the definition of evolution. They would say it's either variation in the gene pool frequency. Does anybody understand what that means? All right. And then I don't know if I ever really do, but the other one they would say is descent with modification. And that's the those are the definitions that biologists like to use for evolution. But you see, evolution is not just about biology. There are theories of evolution dealing cosmically, Big Bang, astronomically, how stars and planets and such form. There are geological theories of evolution. There are theories of the evolution of society. There's an evolutionary theory of law and history and so forth. There's an evolutionary theory of marriage. I should say marriage. All right, marriage is defined in the first two chapters of Genesis very clearly there. And so we believe as creationists, as people who believe the Bible, that is an institution created by God, and we trifle with that institution at our peril. However, if you reject the Bible, you reject God, then you're going to have to come up with some sort of explanation as to why we marry. And I guess it's basically back when we were primitive people, cavemen, if you will, cave women, well, young men would like to have their way with young women, and they would leave the woman pregnant and alone, and it's not good because you need a provider and so forth. That's very sexist today, of course, but they then decided that we needed to arrange to have these young men take responsibility for their actions and help take care of the family. That's why marriage came about as a whole idea. And that's the evolutionary theory of marriage, basically. So if marriage has evolved with us, then we should continue to evolve that institution. And once you grasp that, then you begin to understand why people are wanting to evolve marriage to the next step. They want to have homosexual marriage. You know, it starts to make sense, at least perverse as it is, it starts to make sense if you can get your mind inside of their worldview for just a little bit. And of course, that's completely anathema to us. Just an example of how evolution has permeated all these other human endeavors. Everywhere has been touched by evolutionary thinking. That's the reason why I want to define it very broadly. The definition of evolution I put up here would apply to biological evolution, but also geological, cosmic, astronomical, societal, and so forth. Everything you can imagine is covered by that, because what's missing from that definition? If it's purely natural, purely physical, it excludes what? God, the supernatural. All right, the metaphysical, which is getting to spiritual matters, and God is spirit, as we well know. So consequently, it excludes that. Now, the contrast to that would be creation. And I am not, I'm going to define this very broadly as well as a supernatural process. But lest you be confused on this matter and think I'm going off the reservation here, I'm not talking about just any kind of creation. I'm talking about creation of the God of the Bible. All right? And the Bible gives us that creation. But I want to define it very broadly just so it will be consistent between the two of them. And a big question people have at this point, I suspect most of you won't have this question, but many people do, is it really important what we believe about this? Does it really matter? As long as we have Jesus in our hearts, does it really matter what we believe? And I think the answer to that is yes, it does matter quite a bit. For one thing, I'm going to tell you it colors the way we look at the world. That's what worldview is all about, isn't it? It's your philosophy of life, your viewpoint. It's how you interpret the world around you. I once read about a couple of mountain climbers that get to the top of a mountain, and they get up there, and you can just see for miles. And this one man, one of the mountain climbers, says, "Wow, what a wonderful view." And the other mountain climber said, "Yeah, I've never seen the backside of a buzzard in flight." There's a buzzard flying around. So he's just looking at something very different and interpreting it very different, you see. So if you're an evolutionist or a creationist, you're going to look at the world very, very differently. For instance, a creationist is going to see design and purpose in everything. If you read through the chapter 1 of Genesis very carefully, you will see a lot of care and planning there going into making the world that we have around us. And so you're going to see that design and purpose behind everything. But if you're an evolutionist, if you're an atheist or atheistic worldview, there's not a lot of difference between evolution and atheism, by the way. The evolutionist sees chance and struggle. There's no design. There's no purpose. What is simply is, and there's nothing more to it than that. By the way, that's a depressing way of looking at the world, because if you really think it through, if there is no God, then there is no purpose. You have no purpose. Your life has no meaning whatsoever. And that will lead people to despair if they're really honest about it. Your life means nothing. You were born, you die, and there's suffering in between, but there's not much beyond that. There's nothing beyond that. If you want to attach meaning and purpose to things, that's fine, but it's all in your mind. It doesn't really objectively exist. And the reason why we have such two different contrasting worldviews is because we start with two different assumptions. One is an assumption of theism, that there is a God, and the other is the assumption of atheism, that there is no God. And I find Christians who have this atheistic worldview, they think it's okay, I can believe in evolution, I can believe in billions of years, and you're living like a pagan, you're living like an atheist, and you're not really coming to grips with the fact that that's contradictory to what your worldview ought to be. And I'm really, again, I'm just impressed with the attitudes of the people I see here. I'm very encouraged to see young people who get it. And they really want to learn and strive and live the kind of Christian life we ought to live. And you do that, of course, by taking the Bible very seriously and applying it to our lives. Let me give you a few examples here of differences in the world. I'll show you three photos, I believe, and I'll describe these to you. This is a very famous photograph of a very famous object. It's called the Horsehead Nebula. Can you see the horse head there? And it's called that because the silhouette you see of what appears to be a shape of a horse's head, you'll see across the top half of the photograph this red glow. And that red glow is due to emission from hydrogen atoms. The electrons are making a transition from the third to the second orbital. And as they do, they give off that red light. We call this H-alpha emission. And the electrons are actually pumped up to higher levels by the excitation of a very hot, bright star. Some of those two blue stars you see up at the top and in the middle there to the left of the horse head, they may be responsible for part of that. Now, down below, there is a large cloud of dust particles. The lower half of the photograph there is covered with dust particles. I can see that a couple of ways. Number one, in the lower left, you see that glow down there? It's kind of a bluish glow. That is light that's scattering off of the dust particles. You ever looked at, say, cigarette smoke in very bright sunlight? What color is it? It appears blue, doesn't it? And that's because the light is scattering off of them. You know what color cigarette particle smoke, the particles in cigarette smoke look like? It's kind of a brown, grungy-looking brown color. There used to be a commercial on TV years ago for Topol, this polished for smokers, for their teeth, to keep them white. Had a guy who took a handkerchief and he took a drag and he blew through the handkerchief and they showed you this grungy brown. You don't want your teeth to look like that, so here's your tooth polish to make your teeth look really nice and attractive. Makes me wonder, well, what's it doing to your lungs? I would care more about my lungs. You can get through life a little easier without teeth than you can without lungs. You know, that's a real important point. You ever notice when a car burns oil, what color does the smoke look like? Looks blue, doesn't it? What color are the particles? They're actually black, if you ever collect those and look at them. Again, it's scattering off that. What color is the sky on a clear day, a sunny day? Actually, it's clear. There's no color, but the particles of the atmosphere are scattering off the light. More blue, actually, shorter wavelength, just like the other principles. What color are my eyes? They're clear. I don't have any pigment in my eyes, and the light scatters around, and it looks blue. No one studied my eyes carefully, apparently. I thought that was my most attractive feature. I'm surprised nobody saw it. What color are polar bears? They're clear. All right? They have little hollow pairs and the light scatters off. It does it across the spectrum, so it doesn't factor out that it'll get you the blue, it just gets you the white. What color is snow? It's clear, okay. What color are bluebirds? No, they're actually blue. They have pigment. Okay, it's a little long. I'll give a whole physics lecture on this. Don't have time for that this morning. But the blue color here is caused by scattering of little tiny particles of dust. And you notice, if you look across, I can see clearly, but maybe you can't in the back because the lights are up. But across the bottom half, there seem to be fewer stars than the upper half. Can you all see that? And the reason for that is because this dust cloud sitting on the lower portion blocks light of more distant stars. We can't see beyond it. The dust we're seeing here is on the front side of it. And then there's this little appendage sticking up. I don't know what shape it has in three dimensions, but in two dimensions, it looks like the head of a horse. That's why we call it the Horsehead Nebula. And many of my astronomy colleagues assure me that if they ever find the other half of the nebula, they will name it after me. All right, here we have a photograph of a comet. I believe this is Comet Hale-Bopp. I have to do that every time I say that. You weren't even born yet, were you? How many of you remember Hale-Bopp back in 1997, I believe? It was an incredibly bright comet. People in Manhattan saw it. I don't mean Manhattan, Kansas. I'm talking Manhattan, New York City. I didn't think it was possible to see it, but it was an incredibly bright comet. Never got very close to us. Now, what does a comet, what's it made out of? Well, there's a nucleus that's a few miles across. Hale-Bopp, they believe, was the biggest nucleus we've ever actually seen. It was about 25 miles across. Most are just a mile or two or even less than that. It's made of ices, water ice and other ices with dust thrown in, the same little tiny microscopic particles. And it goes in a very long elliptical orbit around the sun like this. And once each orbit, it comes close to the sun and the heat of the sun will evaporate. We sublime the way those ices that go right from an ice to being a gas. It expands very quickly in the vacuum of space. And the head of the comet to the left is this thing thousands of miles across made of the glowing gas. And then you see the solar wind, little particles going out from the sun, push those gas particles away. And that produces the ion or gas tail going straight to the right. But then solar radiation pushes against the dust particles, they're microscopic, and blows them away. And that's that gracefully going tail going to the upper right. See that blue color? Same blue color. The particles are more gray-brown than the blue. Just a scattering effect occurring again. And then here I have the very famous Ring Nebula. It looks like a little ring in the sky, like a little smoke ring or something. In reality, we used to think this thing was spherically shaped. Now we think it's hourglass, and we're looking down the top of the hourglass. And if you look at the middle, there's a faint little star there. It's a very hot white dwarf type star. We believe a few thousand years ago, this star blew off its outer layers, not in a big explosion, just we call these winds, very windy thing, conditions on certain types of stars, and blew this material out. And a large part of that is the light you're seeing there is caused by the ionization of the gas that's been blown off, and it then starts to glow. With time, it will get farther away, the star will cool, and it'll kind of fade away, disappear into what we call the interstellar medium. By the way, if you have a good-sized telescope, it looks a lot like this through it. We have a 16-inch telescope I usually use at the observatory at the Creation Museum. How many people have been to the Creation Museum again? Okay, good number of you. We have an observatory there. If you come up sometime, let me know you're coming and tell me where I met you, and maybe I can arrange to have you go out there with me some evening if it's clear. But it's looks a lot like that. Not as colorful. It's just kind of white, but it does look like a little smoke ring through that telescope. Really beautiful thing. All right, I showed you three pictures. What did you see? Well, hopefully you all saw some beautiful photographs. All right, that's the neat thing about astronomy. Maybe the thing that really hooked me at a young age is just the wonder and beauty that is there. Now, there's also some interesting physical processes. I snowed through on this talking about H-alpha emission and dust particles and scattering and all that kind of stuff. And if you didn't follow all of that, that's just fine. It's the physics science part. If you're really into physics, it's really cool. You can look at these photographs. You can take other measurements of it, spectroscopy and so forth. And we can figure out a lot of the physical mechanisms involved. So a person who's really plugged into the physics will see the pretty pictures, hopefully, but they'll also see a lot of the physical processes behind it. But there's something else that you ought to be seeing, and that is the Creator's handiwork. And that goes back to Psalm 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork. You see, the Romans 1 talks about the world around us providing no excuse for men. They have to know there's a Creator. It says that in Romans 1 that God exists and is very powerful. Those are the two things that creation will tell you. And I think astronomy is front row on that, indicating all of these things. I can't look at the world and I can't understand why anybody would think that this all happened by itself. Now, you know, most astronomers I know are not atheists. They're some sort of theists. But I don't think they take the Bible that seriously in most cases. And they see the pretty pictures and they see the physical processes. But most astronomers miss the big point. It's like the universe is a big billboard advertising the fact that God exists. And I feel sorry for them because they're missing much of the story here. You've got to be very careful. This happens to me a lot. Maybe it's my age. Maybe it's just things have changed. But I'll be driving along and I'll see a billboard. Or maybe I'll be watching TV and an ad comes on and I'll turn to my wife and I'll say, what are they advertising? And my wife says, I have no idea. Does that happen to you very often? And a lot of the ads, okay, younger people are raising their hands too. Okay, maybe it's not just my age. I used to be cool a long time ago. At least I think I was. But times have changed and a lot of things I just don't get anymore. But at any rate, it's that's what we'll go see here. We have a big billboard. And I'm just not tuned into the message, maybe, and so I don't get the message. And I think the same thing's going on here. If you don't know the Lord, if you're not searching to know Him, if you don't know Him already, then you're going to miss this billboard. And that's really a sad thing. Now, this kind of leads us into design, because I think there is design in the world around us. I'm having a hard time getting a handle on defining design. But I've found in my experience that design is not a conclusive argument. Now, what I mean by that is if one is already convinced that God exists, then it's very easy to see that design in the world around us. But if one is committed to naturalism, then you're going to dismiss any evidence for design. You're going to interpret it a very different way. And on my conclusion this morning, I'll give you a very good example of this. Let me share with you a few things I can see in the world around us from astronomy that suggests there is design. This is a photograph of a total solar eclipse. Anybody here aware of the total solar eclipse on August 21st of this year? I'm sure most of you are. How many of you have plans to see it? Okay, where are you all going? What? Yeah, where do you live? Oh yeah, you're on the path of totality. Anybody live on the path of totality? Okay, a few of you do. The rest of you traveling somewhere? I'm going to Oregon, so... It goes to western Kentucky, but we're in northern Kentucky, so I want the good weather prospects out there. But if you've not made any plans, it may not be too late. The path of totality slashes from just south of Portland all the way out to sea in South Carolina with a lot of the real estate in between. I've seen one total solar eclipse. Back in 1979, my wife and I drove a 22-year-old car 3,500 miles round trip in 5 days in winter. We went way north of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, to see the eclipse for 2 minutes and 46 seconds. And it was the most incredible 2 minutes and 46 seconds I had ever experienced. If I made a top 10 list of the wonderful things I've experienced in my life, it'd probably be number 1, 2, 3, and 4. It was that good. I can't, no picture does justice. No description does justice. You might get the impression I'm kind of outgoing and talkative, right? My wife isn't nearly as much. We ran a recorder during this thing. We played it back later, and it was the weirdest thing. My wife was just chattering away through the whole thing, and I didn't say two words. I was at a loss for words. So if it shut me up, you can imagine how awe-inspiring this thing is. So anyway, when the moon passes in front of the sun, it totally blocks it out for a couple of minutes, and it gets dim. It gets like dusk. It doesn't get like midnight. The brighter stars come out. And you can see the corona, this pearly white outer atmosphere of the sun. Goes out a couple of radii, actually, and it's different every time. Looks different because there are different parts of the sunspot cycle and the magnetic field on it. Now, you can also see around the perimeter of the sun, close in, these things called prominences. Now, this is a photograph made from space. Normally, if you have a very expensive filter called an H-alpha filter, you can see these on any day. In fact, at the Creation Museum, we have a daily, almost daily program in the summer called Sunspotting, where we look at sunspots. If it clears up enough, I have a telescope I'll bring out and show to you, maybe today or tomorrow, if it clears off enough. But you have, if you have a special filter, you can see these blood red prominences sticking out in the edge of space. But you know what? During a total solar eclipse, you can throw those filters away. You just no solar filter required. You look right at the sun, and you can see those blood red loops around it. It's the only time you can look at the sun without any filters. And then at the beginning and the end of the eclipse, there's a little brief, just a little bit of the sun's light coming through, say around through a crater floor. Just for a tenth of a second or so, you get this diamond ring effect. Do you see this diamond ring there? I took this photograph back in 1979. And I've seen other photographs. I think this is one of the better ones. The Lord was very good. I was praying, Lord, please let me get the photograph. I was snapping away, and the Lord was very good. I happened to get the photograph here. Well, what about total solar eclipses? Well, they're pretty rare. One happens about every year or two, a couple of years on the Earth. But usually you have to go to places like Mongolia in winter, or up in Manitoba in winter, or Greenland, or middle of the Pacific, or some wild place like that, Siberia. This is the first one to cross the continental U.S. Since the 70s. So it's a kind of a rare event. I read many years ago that on any given location on the Earth, the on the solar total solar eclipse occurs about once every four centuries. So you either you just happen to live in the right place, you're very lucky, or you make plans to travel someplace to see this. And I will hopefully this summer see my second total solar eclipse. If you missed this one, there's one in 2024, but life is uncertain. I would say go for it right now. Now, here's what's interesting. The sun is 400 times larger than the moon. I used to have my lab students in astronomy. We'd make a little scale model of the solar system, and we'd make the sun about the size of a basketball, and the Earth was about the size of a BB, and the moon, we didn't even make it. It's about one quarter the size of that BB, so it's pretty small. Let's just blow it up a little bit. If I made the moon 1 inch across, the Earth would be 4 inches across, and the sun would be 400 inches across. It's like 30-some feet. Okay, so it's really, really big compared to the moon. However, the sun is 400 times farther away. So if it's 400 times larger but 400 times farther away, then they subtend the same size, the same apparent size in the sky, about a half a degree. So when the moon passes in front of the sun, it just barely covers the sun up. Now, this is has two results. Well, first of all, if the moon were a little smaller or a little farther away from us, sun a little larger, a little closer to us, there would be no total solar eclipses at all. But what if the moon's closer or bigger? Well, we would have more frequent total solar eclipses, and they would not be nearly as spectacular. The fact that they barely crosses, covers it up, and it results in total solar eclipses being spectacular and also being very rare. Now, there are scads of satellites throughout the solar system. Satellites of planets are like 160 of them. I can't keep track of the number. And a lot of them are very small, but they're good sized ones. There's several much larger than our own moon. But if you run through the numbers, you will find that none of the other satellites of the solar system produce rare, spectacular solar eclipses. Either they produce none at all, or they're grossly over total, much larger than the sun, and they happen quite frequently. Only on the Earth do you get that rare combination of the two. And this is the only planet where it matters, because it's the only planet where there are creatures, you and me, who can appreciate this fact. Now, the moon is an incredible object in itself. I think for a long time I wasn't that interested in the moon, but it's really grown on me in recent years. About 15 years ago, I suddenly got my head wrapped around several interesting things about the moon, and I think, well, that's really cool. Is it just coincidence? If it is, how many coincidences are you allowed before you realize maybe things aren't a coincidence anymore? All right. The moon is relatively large compared to the Earth. I already pointed out that it's one quarter its diameter. The moon has about 1.6-1.7% the mass of the Earth. That is, the Earth is about 81 times more massive than the moon. That may sound like a huge difference, but for the other satellites of the solar system, the ratio is many thousands or even millions to one. The other planets, either their satellites are very tiny or the planets are very large or both. But the closest ratio between the mass of a planet and the mass of its satellite is with the Earth-Moon system, and the others aren't even close. Again, they're in the thousands or millions, not even hundreds to one. That's an interesting ratio. Some people call the Earth-Moon system the double planet. If you were to look at the Earth-Moon system from one of the other planets in the solar system, you would clearly see two objects there orbiting together. Now, the Earth is going to be a lot brighter than the Moon is, but it would show up as a double planet. It would be the unique in the solar system. We think, you know, the rings of Saturn are really cool, like I said last night, and other things, but really the Earth and the Moon would have an interesting thing to offer anybody on another planet. Now, the orbit of the Moon is unique as well. You see, most satellites in the solar system, the larger ones at least, orbit in the equatorial plane. You've got the, you know, the polar axis, you've got the equator halfway between, and the planet rotates like this. The major satellites rotate, or orbit, I should say, or they revolve in that same plane that's coincident with the equator of the planet. Now, the planets are typically tilted. Saturn's tilted 30 degrees, so its major satellites have their orbits tilted 30 degrees to the plane of the orbit around the Sun. Jupiter's only tilted 2 or 3 degrees, but its satellites do the same thing, and so on through the solar system. But the Earth doesn't. The Earth's moon doesn't. The Earth's moon is following an orbit close to our orbit around the Sun. It's inclined a few degrees, but it's kind of fine to that orbit. So the Earth, you know, is tilted how much? How much is the Earth tilted? 23.5 degrees. It gives us our seasons. So if the moon were like any other planet, other satellite of the solar system, it would be orbiting like this, perpendicular to the polar axis. But it actually orbits in this plane, the plane that we follow around the Sun. No other satellite in the solar system does that. That's interesting. For one thing, it tells you that the origin of the Moon is unique in the solar system. Remember back when they sent the first probes to Jupiter and Saturn, they said, they gave you all this boilerplate justification for doing this, and they said, we want to study these other satellites because if we do, it will help us find out where our own Moon came from. But if you just looked at the orbits, you'd say, that's not going to work because the origin scenario is unique for the Earth and the Moon. There's a lot of unique stuff about the Earth and the Moon. Again, how many coincidences are you allowed? Oh, it gets even better than that. There are other forces out there, other planets and so forth, tweaking on the Earth. They call these perturbations. Jupiter yanks on the other planets. Mars and Venus yank on the Earth a bit. And the result is that as they yank on it, there's a bulge on the Earth. Where it spins rapidly enough, it's got a greater diameter through its equator than it does through the poles. And over time, those little yanks and tugs would change the rotation axis of the Earth. It would go up towards zero for a while, and it would go down to 90, and then it would come back to zero for a while, go back and forth, waffling around. It takes time to do this, but it would waffle around. Do you see what a problem that would be? If the Earth's axis were tilted 0 degrees, there would be what? No seasons, right? The same seasons, whatever weather you're having now, you're going to have all year long. There would be no cycles like this. What if it's tilted more than 45 degrees? Then much of the Earth's surface would be simultaneously in the tropics and the Antarctic. You'd have a midnight sun some part of the year, and a few months later you would have the sun directly overhead. Would that be problematic for living organisms? Oh, yeah, the plants would have a hard time with that. Plants that are used to the Arctic couldn't handle the tropics, and plants that are in the tropics certainly couldn't handle the Arctic. It would be really a really awful situation. It would be bedlam, wouldn't it? Well, why doesn't that happen? Well, the moon actually, it stabilizes the orbit, the rotation axis of the Earth. It waffles around over maybe 2 degrees. That's it. Slowly over the years, it will go back and forth between about two degree range, and I think we can handle that pretty well. So it stabilizes, but you know what? It stabilizes only if two things are true. If it has this unique orbit that's not in the equatorial plane, it won't work if it's in the equatorial plane. It's got to orbit in the plane we follow around the sun. And number two, it has to have a high mass ratio. It's got to have an appreciable mass compared to the planet itself. Now, again, you can just say, argue, well, that's just a coincidence. But again, how many coincidences are you allowed to have? Also, the presence of our moon made physics possible. I'm not saying that it created physics. I'm simply saying it made physics, our understanding of the physics, the physical world around us, possible. Who invented physics as we know it? Anybody know? Shout it out. Somebody said it. Somebody? Yes, Sir Isaac Newton. He wrote this book called Principia back in the late 17th century. In there, he laid out his laws of motion, three laws of motion, law of gravity. He also invented calculus and threw that in there. Anybody here study calculus? You know, would it ever occur to you to invent calculus? I mean, I can understand it once it's been shown to me, and it's brilliant stuff, but it would never occur to me to do that. Somebody had to do it the first time, and Newton was the man. By the way, how old was he when he did all of this? 22. He was before he was 23 years old, or about 23. How many of you are at least 22 or 23 years of age? What have you done lately? You know, I read about Sir Isaac Newton, and it's incredible. He did all this work by the time he was 23. He kind of turned away from that. Interesting story about him. I won't go into all of this. But he then turned his life, late in life, decades, to study something else. What did he study? Anybody know? What? He studied the book of Daniel. He's fascinated with the book of Daniel, but basically theology. He wrote a book called Optics about his theory of light. We still use, if you take physics in college, you'll spend much of the first semester doing Newtonian physics, and the optics will be Newtonian optics. It still stands after 3.5 centuries. But you know what? As thick as the Principia and optics were, he wrote 10 times as much on theology than he wrote on, and the book of Daniel, than he did on math and science. He thought that if he were remembered at all, he'd be remembered for his theological writings. Well, it just goes to show we're not often a good judge of our own abilities, right? Turns out his theological writings are not that good. But he did take the Word of God very seriously. Well, his big question that he addressed, and this was the big breakthrough that he had, was what compelled the moon to go around the earth every month? You got the earth in the lower left, you got the moon off to the right there. It doesn't show up really well because the reflectivity of the moon is pretty low. You'll find it hard to believe, I know, but the moon's pretty dark and only reflects about 6% of the light that falls on it. It's nearly as black as coal. But compared to the blackness of the night sky, it's pretty bright, all that sunlight is reflecting. But it's pretty dim, actually. So it's orbiting around us. Well, what causes it to happen? You know, from Newton's third law, it says that an object in motion remains in straight line motion. And clearly the moon's not doing that. It's going in a big circle. So there must be a force acting upon it to compel it to do that. That's been a question people have had throughout the ages. And Newton was the first one to actually answer that question in a very good way. And what he came up with was this law of gravity. Now, people, the law of gravity, sometimes people say, well, what goes up must come down. No, that was blood, sweat, and tears, 1969, with spinning wheel. But the older people get that one. All right, but his law actually says that every object in the universe attracts every other object with a force directly proportional to their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. You all caught that? All right, there'll be a test later. What's the answer going to be? Very good. You're paying attention. I'm glad. You're even awake this morning. All right, so he does this new law of gravity, but where did he get that law of gravity? Did he come down off of Mount Oreb with stone tablets that gave it to him? No, he had to figure this out. And his great insight was this. People had believed throughout, and ancient Greeks believed that there were two realms, the terrestrial realm and the celestial realm, the heavenly realm, and things were perfect in the heavenly realms. They followed perfect motions. What's the perfect shape? A circle. So it followed circular motion, uniform circular motion in the heavens. But here on the earth, things were not perfect. Things were far from perfect. And so there was a bit of the fall thrown in there, part of Genesis chapter 3, but it got mangled pretty badly in the process. And during the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church endorsed this viewpoint. That's how they got this separation between the secular and the sacred. There was only really the two duties that were heavenly thinking, and that was the duties of the king and the priest during the Middle Ages. And if you were anything else, well, you were just doing second, third, or fourth best. And the Protestant Reformation changed that. You had the dignity given to manual labor. And it was said by the Reformers that if a plowman was called to be a plowman, if he did it for the glory of God, it was just as honoring to God as the priest or the king was. That was revolutionary. And by the way, that gave rise to the Protestant work ethic. It's not that, you know, Catholics are lazy or something. It's just that, you know, we were now motivated to actually do our best because we're doing it as unto the Lord, as it said in the New Testament, which is exactly what we're doing. So sometimes people get this idea that, if I'm going to be full-time Christian service, I need to be a pastor or a missionary or something like this. Well, you know, the Lord needs other people. I'm full-time Christian service. I've been that for decades. I'm a scientist. I'm not a theologian or a clergyman, but I have a calling to do this. And it's important to feel, to find what your calling is. The Lord needs scientists. He needs engineers. He needs truck drivers. He needs attorneys. Boy, does he need attorneys. And so we really need to find out what our purpose in life is. I'll get off my soapbox and I'll stop preaching at this point. But you need to find out what your calling, and don't be buffaloed into thinking it has to be a pastor. If that's your calling, then that's good and pursue that. But if that's not your calling, then do what the Lord wants you to have. Mine's astronomy, and I've loved it my entire life. I'm doing exactly what God made me to do, I believe. All right, so he separates this separation is now gone. It's not just when talking about human beings, about there's no difference between the sacred and the secular, but also there's no difference between the heavenly realm and the terrestrial realm. And so he says, look, I think the same force that causes the fig to fall off the tree and hit me in the head. Yeah, it was a fig, not an apple. We're talking Newton here, of course. And the fig falls down, hits him on the head. He said, you're slow today, aren't you? So he says, I think the force that makes that fig fall to the ground is the same force that causes the moon to fall around the earth every month. That was a huge breakthrough. And he invented calculus to be able to follow the results of this. So here's what he found. He found out that the moon was 60 times farther away than the radius of the earth. How did he know that? Well, Eratosthenes, I told you the other night, measured the size of the earth 19 centuries before Newton came along. And about 75 years before Newton, a man named Tycho Brahe, a very famous Danish astronomer, was able to measure the distance to the moon pretty accurately. And so by the time Newton comes along, he knows that standing on the surface of the earth, he's 60 times closer to the center of the earth than the moon is. Everybody clear about this? A 60 to 1 ratio. The moon's 60 times farther away from the center of the earth than we are when we stand on the surface of the earth. Now, a result in physics is that it's a center-to-center distance that matters. And so if you're doing calculations for gravity, you want to know how far you are from the center of the earth. So we're 60 times closer to the center of the earth than the moon is. He was able to measure the acceleration required to keep the moon in orbit around the earth. This calculus did that. You get what's called the centripetal acceleration. Calculus, a very simple calculus thing. I used to do this with my students all the time. And lo and behold, he found out that the computed acceleration of the moon keeping its orbit around the earth is 1/3600th of the measured acceleration of gravity on the surface of the earth. 60, 3600. Do you see a relationship between those two numbers? How do you get 60 into 3,600? What do? You square it. And since it's decreasing with increasing distance, this is an inverse square law. Folks, that's how Newton figured out his law of gravity. And physics took off after that. Made this Principia possible. Made physics possible. What if the Lord had never made a moon to orbit the earth? There wouldn't have been a problem for Newton to solve, and he would have never written this Principia, and we wouldn't have had physics. And you might say, woohoo, I didn't take physics in school. Well, hold on there. Engineering is applied physics. And you can just kiss off everything around the room here that you have, like lighting, computers, electricity, air conditioning, probably indoor plumbing. That's really important. You know, so all these great technological advancements have come result of physics along the way. So I think the Lord is very gracious to us to give us a moon to help, so a problem that Sir Isaac, which he also made, could solve that problem. So when we think about physics, we should praise the Lord for Newton and for the moon both, because both are gifts from God, I do believe. Okay, what about the earth? There are some very unique things about the earth. It has the proper distance from the sun. Astronomers today, they're all concerned about finding life on other worlds. And they've decided that there's this range of distance from a star called the habitable zone. If you're too close to the star, it's going to be too hot. You can't have life. You're too far away, it's going to be too cold. You can't have life. And the Earth just happens to again, coincidentally, lie in that habitable zone, just where it's proper to be. But, you know, being at the proper distance from the sun is not good enough. It's necessary, but not a sufficient cause, because the moon also is in that habitable zone, but yet it's dead as a doornail. Why? Well, because it lacks a few things. It doesn't have the right size and density, nor does it have the right composition, and it doesn't have gravity to hold on to a significant amount of atmosphere there, which reminds me, y'all ever heard of the first restaurant on the moon? The food's out of this world. But there's no atmosphere. So, anyway, so the moon, the Earth, the moon cannot sustain life because there is no atmosphere there and the gravity is too small. And also, having an atmosphere is not sufficient in itself either. I mean, necessary but not sufficient, because many of the other atmosphere planets have atmospheres, but they have the wrong kind. They have polyatomic gases in their atmosphere. Polyatomic gases are greenhouse gases. Real quick, is the greenhouse effect good or bad? The answer is yes. You need some of it. If you don't have any greenhouse gases, then the last night the temperature would have plunged to well over 100, below 100 degrees below zero, and today it would be well over 100. The greenhouse gases also block light from the radiation from coming into the atmosphere, so it works both ways. But we need a little bit, but we don't want too much. For instance, Venus's atmosphere is saturated with carbon dioxide, which is a polyatomic gas, and it blocks infrared radiation, and so its temperature is like 900 degrees Fahrenheit day and night. It's really, really hot there, obviously. Well, it turns out the best kind of atmosphere to have, if they've looked at long-term about this, is a nitrogen-based diatomic atmosphere. Diatomic means it has two atoms per molecule. 78% of our atmosphere is diatomic nitrogen, 21% is diatomic oxygen, and the rest is just a mixture of everything else, 1% or less. And only a fraction of a percent, is polyatomic. Ideal atmosphere all over again here on the Earth. Again, it could be a coincidence, I guess. Also, liquid water. There's an interesting thing is, would you agree that liquid water is essential for living things? I could give a whole talk on that. You know, it's got some fantastic properties, but we think liquid water is essential. And did you know that you realize that water is the most abundant molecule in the universe? We see it all over the place. We see it between the stars. We see it on planets and satellites. We see it in asteroids and comets. We even see it in the atmospheres of cool stars. Except everywhere we see it, it's either a solid or a gas. We've never actually detected liquid water anywhere else in the universe. We believe there may be liquid water beneath the surface of satellites of some of the outer planets, but that's not known for sure yet. We've not actually seen it. Liquid water is abundant on the Earth, but nowhere else in the universe. Again, is that a coincidence? Well, how many coincidences are you allowed? Okay, I have here comparing atmospheres. You can look at the terrestrial planets there. Of course, the Earth is on the right center. To the left center is Venus. I've already mentioned its atmosphere is completely wrong. To the upper right of the Earth is the Moon. That one is really no atmosphere at all. Mars to the right of these are all to scale. Mars to the right of the Earth is lacking sufficient atmosphere. It's like 1% or less of our atmosphere. It's very cold. There is a little bit of ice there, a little bit of vapor. If you're an astronaut on the surface of Mars and you took a flask of water and opened it and poured it out, a portion of it would almost immediately boil away, and just boil away, and the other remaining part would freeze. Simultaneously, they have ice and steam at the same time. Far left is Mercury, no atmosphere to speak of there. Or to the right of Mars is one of the larger asteroids, and it doesn't have an atmosphere either. So the planets, the smaller planets, bodies in the solar system where we think life could exist, you look at these, and only on the Earth are the conditions correct. And, of course, we want to talk about water, and I like to hear water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Where does that come from? The rhyme of the ancient, Coleridge that wrote that? I think it was. I'm not a literature guy, but I do know that one. And so water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. And again, water is abundant in the universe, but quite literally, we're not talking about somebody stranded in the middle of the ocean here. There is plenty of water in the universe, but there's not a bit of liquid water, saline or otherwise, there. Not on the moon, not on Venus, not on Mars, not on other satellites of the solar system. So we can do a comparison of other worlds. Venus is lacking in liquid water, and the temperature is way too hot. Mars is way too cold and lacks liquid water. In many respects, people call the Earth the Goldilocks planet because Venus is too hot, Mars is too cold, but the Earth is very good. And then you have the Moon, and then they like to talk about newly discovered extrasolar planets. Have you kept up with this? They've been discovering now for 25 years planets orbiting other stars. This was just, you know, speculation until 25 years ago. Anybody know how many planets we found orbiting other stars now? Guess? More than 3,500. There are a lot of planets out there. All right? Okay. So extrasolar planets are planets orbiting other stars. And there are several methods used to find that. The best method we have is from the Kepler mission. They've got a little artist illustration of what the Kepler satellite looked like. It had a mission of 2 or 3 years. It's still actually an extended mission going on now. But it was looking for transits of extrasolar planets. And I will show you what a transit looks like. Imagine if you have a star, and it's a little yellow ball you see there. And imagine there's a planet orbiting around it. See that little orange, a little red ball, and it's got an orbit going around it. And notice that we're looking at it nearly from the orbital plane of the planet. If the planet's orbiting like this, you're not going to see anything. Only if it's going to be orbiting like this can you notice this. As the planet moves from left to right, it's not blocking any of the star, and then it blocks it for a while. And then it stops blocking. If you look below there, they have what's called a light curve. The light goes along like this, and then it dims, and then it recovers. And that dimming is caused by a transit of a planet, like a little eclipse. And a transit is an eclipse where the smaller body passes in front. Now, if you were on an alien world in another solar system, and you're looking back towards the Earth and the Sun, if you're right in the orbital plane of the Earth, then once every year, every 365 or so days, the sun would dim by about 1 part in 10,000. That's 0.01%. And it would dim for a maximum of about 13 hours. Once a year it would do that. So the Earth is detectable from other planets if they lie in our orbital plane. Well, the Kepler satellite was able to measure a few hundred thousand stars every 20 minutes, and it did it with a precision of 1 part in 1,000,000. So a planet like the Earth orbiting a star like the Sun would be easily showing up in this. And here's some actual data right there. I got a little fake light curve at the top. This is actual data here. You got scatter in the data, but it's pretty constant with the scatter. Then it drops down and recovers and goes back. And by studying the duration of this thing and the shape of the eclipse curve, we can figure out things such as the size of the planet in question. And Kepler has discovered probably more than half of all the extrasolar planets we now have. So why do astronomers want to look for extrasolar planets? I think it's really cool just to look for them, to find out what's there. But they want to prove that planets are common in the solar and the universe, and they appear that they have shown that to be the case. They want to prove that solar systems are common, that is, a star with a number of planets orbiting around it. And then they want to prove that Earth-like planets are common. And then they want to prove that the life is common in the universe. You see the progression there. Planets, solar systems, Earth-like planets, and then finally life. Do you see the evolutionary underpinning there? Yeah, because, you know, why do they want to prove life exists elsewhere? Well, if life arose on the Earth and nowhere else, then that makes the Earth unique by definition. And if the Earth is unique, it makes it special. And if the Earth is somewhat special, then that drags you right back to creation, doesn't it? So they have to prove that life exists somewhere else in the universe. What have we found so far? First of all, we found that planets are common indeed. We're only finding a fraction of the possible planets, and we found that 3,500, that means for every one we find are probably a few score that we can't find, but they're there anyway. They've also found that solar systems may be common because we found a number of stars now that have multiple planets. We had one reported in the news just a couple of months ago that they discovered, I think, 7 planets orbiting this star, and they thought 2 of them were Earth-like. If you want to know more about it, just go to our website. Every time one of these comes up, I write a web article, answersingenesis.org. You'll find several of my articles written on these extrasolar planets. They've also found that, however, that Earth-like planets are not common, despite what you hear in these news reports. It takes me about 5 minutes on the Internet to find out several things wrong with A, the star that it orbits, or B, the planet itself. My opinion is, and it's based up with good evidence, that there are no Earth-like planets. Out of the 3,500 we found zilch that are Earth-like. And so if I say here they're not habitable, no habitable planets yet, and that tells me, I think, that the solar system is unusual, and at some point it has to be unique. 3,500 is a large data set. You've probably never heard a scientist conclude that scientifically we're alone in the universe, but we are. And I'll share that with you on Thursday a little bit. I'll wrap up with this. There's this thing called the anthropic principle. It was coined by a man named Brandon Carter back in 1973. And what he meant by that is there are a number of coincidences or characteristics of the universe that seem to make the universe ideally suited for our existence. That is, if you change this quantity a little bit, then life would be impossible. If you change this characteristics a little bit, life would be impossible. And start totaling this up. It's pretty impressive. You can even apply this to planets themselves. The Earth, as I said, is pretty unique, not only because we can muse about that and think that it is, but also we now have data that suggests very strongly that it is. And so it starts looking like design going on in all of this. Well, back about over 30 years ago, there were two astronomers named Barrow and Tipler who wrote a book called The Anthropic Principle. It goes on for over 1,000 pages. It's a pretty thick book. And they give the history of thought on the anthropic principle. They define it. They give a weak and a strong form of it. They give different variations on it. It's a pretty exhaustive treatment of the anthropic principle. And when they, all is said and done, they get to the end of the book, they do have the conclusion, and their conclusion is the universe only appears to be designed. And that's what I mean by when I said at the very beginning of my talk that design is not a conclusive argument. Because, you see, when confronted with the facts, people will choose not to believe many times because of the hardness of their hearts. You know, there in the first century, one of the best evidences for the reality of Jesus Christ was the empty tomb. And one of the Gospels records that they even bribed the Roman guards to lie about what happened. They knew the tomb was empty. They knew the Roman guards didn't fall asleep on the job. They had all the evidence right before them to say, you know, he really did rise from the dead. He really is Emmanuel. And yet, they didn't believe. You see, it's not a head problem. It's a heart problem. That's the whole problem there. If your heart is hardened, you're going to make up all sorts of excuses. Well, the universe appears to be designed, but that's all that it is. Well, each time I've spoken, I've shared with you some resources that I brought with me. I have three books out right now. This is my third book. Actually, it's my second book, but I'm not doing it in chronological order. It's called The New Astronomy Book. It's beautifully illustrated. It's primarily intended as a kid's resource like middle school. But I've had many adults, friends of mine, read it, and they said they got a lot out of it. They didn't think it was a kid's book at all, but I intended it as a kid's book. It's very beautifully illustrated. It's color-coded for three different levels. A lot of homeschooling families are using it as a unit on astronomy, and they can actually use it 3 years because they can do it when they're younger, use the first level, and the second level, and the third level. And many of you might get something out of it as well. I know you're well-read young people, but you might learn a lot of stuff from this book. And we have those out there as well. And again, if you haven't been by the book table, please come by. We have some specials. Just ask me about what we have. I'll be happy to share with the options that we have. Well, thank you very much.